KCSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor of law at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm very excited to have on Professor Tom Streeter, author of the book The Net Effect, Romanticism, Capitalism, and the Internet. This is a book that I came across through contacts on a listserv that focuses on internet research. And this book, and as I said to Tom, is I think one of the best books that I've read on the internet itself, which is particularly high praise given the authors that I've had on the show. What Tom does in this book is trace the history of the internet from its early days through the prism, the sociological prism of primarily romanticism, tied into the question of the focus of much of internet activity today, which is the theoretical free market and the interest in making money through using technology. So the net effect begins our discussion at the early stages of the internet, but goes right up to today, tracing these threads. The book itself is under 200 pages, but chock full of terrific information as well as outstanding sites. As I mentioned to Tom, I have in reading his book a few times, I have heavily marked it for my own research as well as for the interview. But the idea behind the book and what we're going to be focusing on today is this notion that, as Tom calls it, the romantic individualist representation of computing. The idea of the person, the idealist, sitting at the computer, attempting to come up with the perfect technology, fretting away late at night on their own, with limited outside access, and coming up with these wonderful technologies. And throughout the book, Tom weaves this theme and tries to assess how it is that the internet developed as it did through the context of its history, the history beginning in the 60s, or even the late, even earlier than that, as far as the theoretical underpinnings of it, back to the post World War II era, coming out of the ashes of a terrible world war, and indeed the efforts to both end that war and also at the same time create technologies that would survive a war. And we're going to talk a little bit about that conception, or perhaps misconception, of the internet through the 50s, and a time of increasing economic activity and kind of a time where the efforts of the United States was to put war and its concepts behind us, through the counterculture of the 60s into the 70s and 80s and up to today. And while there's been quite a bit of writing, I think, on the more recent history of the internet, that is roughly, I'd say, you know, post-1990, I think Tom spends a good amount of time on a part of the history of the internet that I think we largely ignore today, that era in the 70s and 80s. And so I'm very excited to have Tom on to kind of trace these issues. Like so many of the interviews I do on Hearsay Culture, we can only dig only very little into all of the concepts in the book. We, even in an hour, we tend to do a surface view, but we will drill down on some of these questions, including what I think is a very interesting discussion of the birth of the cyber law movement, and a discussion of Larry Lessig's work. So Tom is a professor of sociology at the University of Vermont. He's also the author of Selling the Air, A Critique of the Policy of Commercial Broadcasting in the United States. He's joining us via Skype from Vermont. We are recording this show on November 20th for airing on November 21st, so it is a timely interview. Tom, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture.
It's a great pleasure to be here, David.
Tom, let me start off with a question I ask most of my authors, which is to tell us a bit more about your background and how you became interested in writing this book.
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of people doing work on the internet these days who kind of came of age professionally in the 1990s, particularly late 1990s, when the internet was a hot topic and huge claims were being made on its behalf. And so there was a huge amount of optimism. And I'm different. I started graduate school way back in 1980. And one of the things I was looking at the time was cable television, which actually had been sold as a grand new technology back in the 1970s, when and it was, you know, promoted as the next thing that will bring democracy and solve all kinds of social problems. And by the 1980s, you know, it was becoming an interesting but very commercial medium, and, you know, the utopian part was being quickly dropped like a hot potato by most people in the industry. And so I got curious about what was going on there and spent a large part of my early career being rather skeptical about claims that technology changes everything, and making the case that often when people are talking about technology, particularly when they talk about technology in utopian or grandiose terms, that really they're talking about something else. It's kind of politics in disguise. And so I came up as a fairly skeptical about this. Now, when I in the 1990s, nobody wanted to hear this.
Right.
And in fact, because the internet was kind of, you know, particularly by, you know, 1997, 98, the stock bubble was going up. And, you know, if I talked to an editor or, you know, even some colleagues and start saying, you know, I think this stock bubble, I don't think it's really true that the laws of economics have been changed by the internet. And this is a bubble. It's not, you know, the new economy, as everybody put it back then. You know, people would, it's not that they'd argue with you. They just kind of start looking over your shoulder and for someone really worth talking to. Right. And so I kind of was struggling with how to account for all the excitement about the internet. But then, of course, the internet has made a difference. It's at least as important as, say, the coming of radio or the coming of the motion picture film or something like that. And you can't tell the history of the United States, certainly, and in some ways of the world for the last three or four decades without talking about the internet in some role. So I came at this with a kind of habit of skepticism about grand claims about technology, while at the same time wanting to really account for what has been happening, how do we best kind of tackle the reality of the situation.
You know, and that, and I think that at least critical skepticism, I think, does run through the work, and I think it's a useful bulwark against against not only perhaps grandiose visions of the internet, but also some of the other, as we'll talk about shortly, misconceptions about the birth of the internet itself. In order to get into your broad themes before we drill down on some specific topics, I do want to ask you to define some terms. You call the book The Net Effect. That's the title. But before I get to the title, I want to define a couple of those subtitles you have. So what is, in your view, or how do you define romanticism?
Yes, thank you for asking that, because the romanticism, you know, it's a really fun term. I find when I talk about romanticism to audiences, everybody wants to jump in and play with the word. It's, but I actually mean something pretty technical. It's not a kind of loose term, or I'm trying to get at something fairly technical about it. So by romanticism, I'm talking about a set of common habits of thought and action, that seem to exist as something like a cultural toolkit in Western societies, in American society in particular. And so I'm not talking about, you know, a period in European history in the early 1800s, or nor kind of a particular set of literature, like a literary canon, but rather a social set of practices. And I think those practices have a number of traits. One is an idea of oneself not as a, say, calculating rational self, nor as a, say, managerial kind of self where you're supposed to, you're sort of a bureaucrat designed to solve certain problems according to an institution's needs. Those are kinds of selves that actually we all kind of step into those roles now and then in our lives. But the romantic self understands oneself, one's selfhood, as a process. And it's a process of exploration, not of, and that follows its own internal logic rather than something, well, you know, in utilitarianism, where utilitarianism would tell us that we're all rationally calculating all the time to pursue our own self-interest in a kind of strictly means and ends determined way, whereas a romantic idea of the self, which actually partly evolved in kind of dialogue with and the utilitarian idea of the self, a romantic idea of the self is one where you can't predict outcomes, where the goal is the process itself. And I don't think this is unique to the internet. I think it's something that people turn to at odd intervals, Western societies, and maybe now to some degree in Eastern societies. I can't generalize about that, but some people have suggested to me that's the case. But people kind of, you know, it's something you can draw on in your life to define yourself at certain moments. And this could be, you know, in a therapy session. It could be in 60s counterculture. It could be, you know, over a candlelit dinner. But what struck me was that people came to at moments, and it became collectively organized, that people did so in association with computing technology. So, I'm interested in romanticism, not as a theory, not as a set of texts, but as something that people do, something that people use to get through life at odd moments. But that's something that has consequences often beyond what we intended to have.
We're chatting with Tom Streeter, author of the book The Net Effect, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Tom, so that definition of romanticism, I think, stands in stark contrast with another word that you use in the subtitle, at least the way people generally think about it, which is capitalism. So in order to, again, contextualize our discussion, what do you mean by capitalism in the context of this book?
Well, as a sociologist, that's interesting because, of course, that's actually a really good question, although we often use the word as though we know exactly what it means. I use it to mean a system of organizing human relations based on property relations and market relations. And that's at its broadest. And I think there's actually many varieties of capitalism and both in the world today. There's different ways of doing things on a market basis, different ways that can mean different things. But it's, you know, you turn life into a process of rational negotiation over values assigned to objects in the world on a marketplace basis. As a sociologist, and this is something, there's a subfield of economic sociology that unfortunately is not as well known as I think it should be, that sort of has been in a long-term dialogue with the field of economics. And one of the arguments that's inherent in the field of economic sociology is that capitalist market relations, there's nothing natural about them. They have to be made. They have to be constructed. And so what economic sociologists get interested in is, how do markets come to be in the first place? How do people acquiesce to the idea of property? How do people make property into property when we often deal with things in other ways as well? So economic sociology kind of takes what an economist would call externalities and makes them primary. And kind of says externalities aren't external to capitalism. They're necessary to it. They're foundational. There's a kind of bedrock under a sociological bedrock upon which capitalism is built that is itself not market-based.
I just want to interrupt you, Tom, just to be clear. So a sub-definition, externalities, meaning the impact of a given activity on those outside of its direct core. Is that a fair statement, or just for those that aren't familiar with the term?
Externalities are things that when you're discussing a particular economic problem, they are features that influence prices and economic behavior, but that are understood to be external to the market that's mm-hmm. being discussed. Mm-hmm. And sociologists like to kind of turn that on its head and say all that stuff that economists call externalities is actually often prior to or necessary to or foundational to the market rather than something that kind of comes in from the outside.
Now, let me connect those two dots before we get into some of the themes with the title, the net effect. And so at a top level, what do you mean by the net effect?
It's kind of a pun.
Yes.
I don't look at the effect of the internet on various aspects of life. On families or, you know, mark on media or something like that. But I am interested in how the internet came to be. And I think as a social constructionist, how things come to be is often certainly the beginning of the sociological question, you know, how do families come into being? How do markets come into being? How do technologies come into being? But in a certain sense, they're often the end of the discussion too, because I think how the internet came into being is an awful lot of its history is embedded in how we understand what it is. So that that's why I like to say the net effect is of the internet is in the making of it. How the internet Our experience of the internet isn't just as of a thing that was sort of sitting there and then people started to interact with it, but it's precisely how it came to being in this rather surprising way that seemed to overturn assumptions that which I think is a interesting and significant but very historically contingent or in a certain sense accidental set of affairs, that's a very important part of what makes the internet what it is, how it was socially constructed.
And if so I want to drill down. I'm going to ask you one more, I recognize, top-level question. But if there is a theme running through your sociological history of the development of the internet, or if you would care to point to one theme, what would you want that to be, or what would you say it is?
It's that question makes me a little bit nervous.
Yes.
One of the things I take some pains not to do in the book is argue on the level of, say, some sort of dominant ideology, like one idea or one set of ideas that kind of is expressed everywhere you look.
So maybe to be clear, I rather than answer the question I've asked, that was a theme that I thought was there. So that, I mean, by theme, I mean perhaps it is that conception of the internet, which we're going to talk about in a moment, from the concept of, as I mentioned in the introduction, this idea of the internet having been developed to survive a nuclear blast. So is the theme, or maybe wrong third word, is the thread running through the history of the internet a misconception of a dominant operating principle of it?
That may be captured kind of what I'm trying to get at is the very real, very important, but in a certain sense historical pile of accidents that the internet is. And it that and this is, you know, one of the reasons why I say it's, you know, this is not a book about what's coming.
Right.
Because the pressure to talk about that whenever you talk about new technologies is, okay, what's next? And I try to focus very, very hard on just what actually happened.
And, you know, that, and I guess I'm going to ask, I was debating whether to ask this question, but I think I'm going to in light of what you just said. And this is going to sound like a very academic, wonky type question, but I think it's important given what you're doing. But I think you partially answered it. Where do you place your book in the range of scholarly literature on the internet? Because like I said in the introduction, there's quite a bit out there now. But you're not pulling out the crystal ball. So I'm curious, and you partially have answered it, so maybe you don't have anything to add to it, but where would you place your work in that range?
Well, it's not, you know, it's not a work of original history where I went through archives and tried to do it. I mean, one book cannot do a complete history of the internet. And there's really good work out there, that's some of which has come out and more which is coming out, about the detailed history of specific aspects of the internet. And that's not what I'm trying to do. It is an interpretive history. It's summative. It's in a bit of a critical dialogue with a lot of what's been done about the internet since the late 1990s, what's been published about the internet, because I think it's, you know, some people call it presentist. It's there's a pressure when you're talking about the internet to speak of it as though it represents a big break from everything that's come before, and to sort of want to take it outside history and to look forward and to prognosticate about where it's going. And you know, I'm a deep believer in the idea that sometime prognostication is not the best way to face the future, because it's that really a very rich, complex understanding of what has just happened, or what has happened in the deep past. Either one is a better way to approach the future wisely. So yeah, it's in terms of works on the internet, I'm in a dialogue with a lot of the presentism that is out there, and a lot of which is often very good work, but then I'm also, you know, and this is not exactly your audience, but people who write about culture and cultural studies and things like that, I do want to make the case for those kind of folks that that you can talk about things other than texts, you know, other than novels, other than movies, other than TV shows, to talk about culture, that culture is present in things we often imagine it not to be, like technology, and that you can, by being a kind of cultural sociologist or a cultural studies person, looking at the fine-grained aspects of technology development and policy, that's like a good use of cultural theory. So that's another kind of point or dialogue I'm engaged in with the cultural studies folks.
We're chatting with Tom Streeter, author of the book The Net Effect, on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Tom, before we take a quick break in a couple minutes, let's drill down on one of those themes. As I mentioned in the introduction, I mentioned a few times now, one of the first myths, if you will, and you call it that, or folklore, of the founding of the internet is this concept that the internet's was invented and designed in a way so that it could withstand a massive nuclear strike. And you say in the book that this is too simple a conception. And it comes, that point comes under the heading, Building Big Systems the American Way, Corporate Liberalism and the Military-Industrial University Complex. So there's a lot there, which, and some of which we'll pick up after the break. But let's start with that myth. Why is it too simple to say that the internet was invented with a structure to withstand nuclear war?
Well, and you know, this is a number of other people have pointed this out, that the people who the original pioneers of the internet were thinking a lot of about a lot of other things as well, and so I think you know, I think one reason that it was designed to survive a nuclear war, that thing is, it's a useful way to kind of explain what distributed computing is and how it works. But I think there were a lot of different people working with communication systems and computers and thinking a lot of different things in the 60s and early 70s. And the surviving nuclear war just goes back to its Baran, isn't it? It's a piece that came out of the Rand Corporation. That's what everybody cites. And that was just one small piece of the things people were thinking about why packet switching and computer communications in general would be a good idea. That's too simple. I mean, then want me to talk about the military?
Well, here's what I was about to say. What we can do is, let me do a quick public service announcement, and then we're going to come back and talk about what corporate liberalism is and how that fits in here. So we're listening to KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can, ways you can make a donation, You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to keep listening to the station and to the show. So, yeah, Tom, let's jump right back in. And I'll ask you, this concept, again, of corporate liberalism runs through the book, and it kind of, it kind of wanes and then grows again, depending on where we are in this sociological study of the history of the internet. How does that tie into this myth?
I think, you know, I like the idea of corporate liberalism because it, on the one hand, it's a way of trying to explain why big government and big business have kind of developed hand in hand over the 20th century rather than being seen as opposites, as our dominant political discourse tends to present them. And that corporate liberalism is very roughly a way of organizing the economy or imagining the organization of economy and society that tries to square the existence of giant multi-unit private for-profit corporations, those big bureaucracies that are so important to our economy, with the basic ideas of liberalism in the classical sense, with individualism and an idea of rights and freedoms as an essential part of a good society. So, and corporate liberalism is a set of ways of thinking, sometimes formalized, often not, that try to square those two things. How do you have these big, giant, global corporations that are very bureaucratic and hierarchical? How do you square those things with the free liberal individual? And corporate liberalism is a way of kind of balancing those two things. When people talk about Vannevar Bush in terms of the internet, they often cite, you know, his early proposal for the Memex. But I try to make the case in the book that his much more important role was what he was actually most famous for in his lifetime, which was developing the dominant model of technology development in the post-World War II era, where which came out of the Manhattan Project, and he published Science, the Endless Frontier, which was a proposal that basically led to the creation of the National Science Foundation. The idea is the way you get good technology is you use government funding to do the basic research in science technology because it's too risky to do kind of exploratory stuff there's too much unknown to expect a private for-profit efforts to do the basic research. And then once the basic research starts to get developed, it gets passed on to a private enterprise for, you know, turning into consumer products or turning into marketable products of various sorts.
Let me interrupt you, Tom, only because for those that aren't familiar, you started to talk about, but who was Vannevar Bush? Because he's obviously a critical figure in the development of the internet, but not a name necessarily that everyone knows.
He's an MIT scientist in the 30s, and particularly during the 40s and 50s, became quite prominent. I think is best understood as one of the creators of the National Science Foundation and the model for technology development that represents.
So go on. Yeah, sorry. I just want to make sure people knew who he was.
On the one hand, the Bush model of technology development has been hugely successful. It brought us satellite communication, microwave ovens, computers, jet airplanes, and to a large degree, the internet. On the other hand, it's a reigning idea, not a popular one, because it blurs the boundaries between public and private. It's that the military-industrial complex is basically an epithet, whether it's coming from the right or the left. And it's the basic justification for the existence of the military-industrial complex. So I think one of the things that interests me is that we have this thing that it's almost sacred in certain circles as a way to develop technology, but it's politically dicey once you get to the level of Congress. And I think there's good reasons for it to be politically dicey. So the internet, you know, on one hand, the idea that the internet was designed to because people wanted to survive a nuclear war is too simple. It does point to a larger truth, which is that it came out of an organized nexus of corporate government and also, very importantly, university funding that was funding and practice that was drawn on that was kind of based on the Bush model of and so the thing about the Vannevar Bush model of technology development is it was hugely influential. It had huge impact, and it's politically problematic because for the majority of citizens, it creates this world where there's kind of insider groups doing all this mysterious stuff that seems remote from their everyday experience. And I think, you know, American society, a lot of things be seen as struggling efforts to address that problem. How do we make technology development something that makes sense on the level of everyday life, where you don't have to have a PhD or be a corporate manager for it to seem rational to you?
One of the it does tie in nicely with some of the other writing you do in this early stage regarding Linklater, who I also want to ask you to describe or introduce to those that aren't familiar with him. But you talk about how many of the people, certainly Bush, Linklater, and others, these were not philosophers. These were not people who were thinking about computing from a philosophical or sociological standpoint. But they were scientists and engineers. But you point out that, and in your early discussion, in a chapter interestingly titled "Self-Motivating Exhilaration," you wrote that Linklater's no philosopher, but by suggesting that question formation might be brought into the computing process, the question is, what is the question? He's expressing a certain wise frustration with the technocratic ideal of instrumental rationality characteristic of the institutional world he inhabited. So there's a lot there, but I do want to get into that a little bit. The context in the world in which these early innovators of the internet and inventors of the internet, literally, were operating was one quite different than the world that we think of today as governing the internet. So how was it that asking the right question became so important in the early stages of the creation of the internet?
Well, there's a certain kind of, given the military-industrial university complex, given the big institutions that were moving into computing by the certainly in the 50s and then still in the early 60s, they were big expensive things, and the practice of batch processing, where you had to, most people who used computers had to kind of print out a huge pile of cards, carefully design a program, and then print it out in these cards and then give it to a computer operator, and you'd get a response, hours or days later. It sort of lent itself to a separation of means and ends that worked well with the self-image of large bureaucratic institutions. It seemed regulable, rational. You had central institutions defining what the goals and purposes were, and then everything fanning out from that down the hierarchy, serving those things in various ways. And Linklater, is it Linklater or Linklater?
I've never been quite sure of the pronunciation myself, so I'll defer to either pronunciation.
I'll say Linklater just because that's what pops in my head.
Okay.
But he had the unique experience of working on the predecessors and what became the early warning system, where batch processing was impractical. So those were that's actually the early warning system in the 50s for that was designed to alert and respond to incoming Soviet missiles, basically. And because there was a need for speed, they made them interactive. And he would mess around with these things and took great pleasure in it. That sort of sense of compulsive addiction that we all know about now in terms of our interactive computers, the way they suck you in. He was one of the first people to not just have that experience, but try to give it some larger meaning rather than, just the treating it as a peculiarity. And so he was, I think, famous not so much as someone as a genius inventor, but as someone who tried to come up with justifications for interaction with a computer, which was a very unusual way of thinking how to interact with the computer. And so that's why in some of his early work, when he talks about computers should be used in question formation rather than in the process just of answering predetermined questions. And that's kind of philosophical move. It has philosophical implications. I think in retrospect we can say we're quite interesting, because then if a computer isn't just for fulfilling completely pre-given ends, but is rather something that one can explore with and interact with and have unpredictable outcomes, if a computer is actually an interesting unpredictability machine rather than something that's just used for prediction, what do we do with it? How do we make sense of that? And I think Licklider and a few other people when they were sort of playing around with computers and say, look, you can do different things with them back in the 60s. And they were a minority, a powerful minority. He had a lot of authority. But they were a minority at the time. That was kind of the door, new ways of thinking about what a computer might be for.
And so the romanticism theme that runs there is I think one of, and correct me if I'm wrong, this notion, again, as I said in the introduction, of the individual working at a computer station. Am I fair in saying that, or am I simplifying it too much?
Yeah, I think there's always a question of who am I when I'm doing something? Who am I when I sit down to use a computer? And there's, in any given time and place, there's a variety of available answers. You know, am I a bureaucrat? Am I just trying to get a task done that in a very specific way? Or am I an explorer? Am I trying to have something happen that hasn't happened to me before, you know? And so do I want to find something new and unexpected rather than solve an expected problem? And I think Licklider started, and he just started. Others took it in a more formal direction or more fully articulated direction. He was read in a way that kind of said, hey, look, you can be someone else when you're using a computer. You can be something other than a cog in a big institutional machine. And, of course, that then, as the 60s progressed, became a very attractive idea in certain circles and opened the door for people like Ted Nelson and Stuart Brand to start saying, hey, computers can be something completely different.
We're chatting with Tom Streeter, author of the book The Net Effect, on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Tom, we're about 10 minutes out from being out of time, and so I started asking some unfair questions at this point in the interview. Unfair meaning you don't have enough time to answer them, particularly in a sociological history. This is that time factor plays a big role. I want to jump ahead in the time we have left to your read on the birth of the cyber law movement, and you write a bit about Larry Lessig, who, again, to be clear, by way of caveat, was the founder of the Center for Internet Society and certainly is a mentor, was major mentor of mine, and someone whose views have highly influenced what I do. But you talk about the optimism, decades after the events that we just discussed in the cyber law movement. So perhaps you could offer, your sociological read on Lessig and the birth of cyber law, a field that I focus on, and a field that is in even in its early history changing drastically. What do you have to say there?
Well, I'm a great admirer of Lessig, and I actually met him quite early on in his career once. But I sort of use him in the book as a kind of model for something that I think was happening to a lot of people. And I think, when the internet started to take off, it was sort of open, when it started to spread outside of the technical world in the early 1990s, it kind of took people by surprise. A lot of people, certainly people who had been working on it, weren't surprised. But certainly in the kind of worlds of the media and the worlds of politics and the worlds of corporate management, it kind of seemed to come from nowhere all of a sudden. And I think it thus became sort of temporarily up for grabs as a thought object. You could ascribe all kinds of different meanings to it. And I, by the way, I don't think that's something that's completely separable from the technology itself. The way that people project onto technology and what the technology is often in complicated ways become intertwined. But I think, so when the internet first kind of surprised everybody, appeared on the scene, you know, there were different groups who wanted to make different meanings out of it. So actually the first group, I think, historically, that started to get some purchase there was libertarians, Esther Dyson, some people. And, you know, and they thought it was a sort of libertarian utopia, and which was a little bit ironic given that it was something was largely, certainly in 1992, 93, when all this happened, it was still largely funded through the military-industrial complex and with a lot of university funding, a lot of nonprofit funding. And but, you know, it was a cultural thing, and with culture kind of comes with its own – you have to be – have a sense of irony about things. And so, you know, the libertarians were the first ones in, and I think – but not long on their heels. A few other people who'd been interested in, say, intellectual property law, and, you know, Jamie Boyle and some other folks who'd been kind of gnawing away at issues, and they saw the internet as an opportunity to say and do things that they wanted to say and do but couldn't find another place where they'd actually get much purchase. So you know, there's a good interview with Lessig where he says, look, you know, in the law, there's so many things that are depressing that I disagree with, and you just can't do anything about them. But in the internet, it seemed like there were possibilities. There were things that could be done. And I think that feeling was there in the foundation of cyber law. And so a lot of people started moving into the area, not just because they'd always had an interest in technology or they had a very specific set of expertise, but because it was this new uncharted realm that offered more room for maneuver, more room for doing things that didn't seem calcified or stuck in ruts like so much of the law and policy world elsewhere seems to be sometimes. So the internet appeared as a kind of enticing blank slate in the early days of cyber law. And I think cyber law, it developed in dialogue with libertarians. It's not there's a kind of still a libertarian current within what people call cyber law. But I think Lessig and some of the others who jumped in early on were thinking about the limitations of libertarian ways of thinking. And Code is Law is very much about how describing the internet not as an area that where you can be free of government restriction, but rather something that itself can restrict. And so that was an interesting and important move. Now, the other thing that Lessig did was, and I don't know if he'd accept this as a fair justification, whereas, you know, you look at some of his very early work on constitutional law and he quotes Foucault and stuff, and Foucault would be very skeptical of the idea of the romantic self. The post-structuralists were famously very skeptical of the idea of the unique expressive individual as something that explains anything. You can look at Jamie Boyle's first book, where he Shame and Software and Spleens, where he talks about ecology. The idea that authors are unique creators of works, and he kind of used for a more civic republican point of view where you understand authors as existing in a social context and heavily dependent on people around them. And Lessig didn't make that move. He didn't, when he moved into what became cyber law, he didn't say the free individual subject is an illusion. He rather said he embraced it and said what the internet is great is it involves a place for free individuals to express themselves, but we have to protect that. at the corporate model, the libertarian model, the idea that if we just turn everything into property, that's not going to work to support the free expressive individual. It's not going to create the freedom that we want if we turn it all over to the market. And so that move, I think, was in a certain sense, an embrace of the romantic individualism of American culture in the context of the internet, and a hugely powerful and successful one, because it really appealed to people. I mean, one of the things that I don't want to say is that Lessig was wrong to do that. I think there are limits to doing it that way, and I think, you know, it. But I think it had a huge impact to be able to say, to talk about the romantic individual expressing themselves in cyberspace on the internet, and to make arguments out of that were hugely popular. And I think that's an important part of why his work has been so effective.
Tom Streeter, author of the book The Net Effect: Romanticism, Capitalism, and the Internet, an outstanding book. And I think, you know, Tom, I'm going to ask you this question, and this is the one question I'm asking. It is directed perhaps at law professors and other people writing in law, and I'm going to ask you to answer this question in about 1 minute. But if you have, having looked at the sociological history, what would you say to legal scholars in terms of contributions that we as a community should be making to our understanding of the internet? So I really am asking you for a kind of a top wish to come from legal scholarship as we think about the internet. What would it be? What should we be doing?
Well, anyone who's a legal professional, of course, at some point, you necessarily have to be doing the work of kind of guessing what judges are going to say about a particular argument, or what the judges, legislators are going to do. So you have to prognosticate in that kind of narrow practical sense. And I don't think people should stop that. But I think, you know, I heard someone interviewed about intellectual patenting software, a law professor not long ago. And he said that the interviewer said, you know, asked him, the guy had some ideas for patent law reform, and the interviewer pressed him on, but do you think patenting software is an effective thing to do at all? Should we maybe not do it at all? And the law professor kind of hemmed and hawed and said, well, you know, that horse is out of the barn. And they're going back on that. And yeah, when you're talking to a legal client, yeah, that's probably what you have to say. That's a reasonable thing. But the larger world that over, you know, a decade or more, a larger political cultural discussion that lawyers are a part of, that lawyers might want to also think about. Whereas, you know, if you're a lawyer and your best judgment is it's just a mistake to patent software in the first place, you don't have to say that to your clients, but you maybe want to say that to the larger public. You want to participate in a larger dialogue that goes on in a larger world besides the world of law schools and courts and all those things that lawyers do as on a day-to-day basis. So, you know, occasionally I'd invite lawyers to jump into the much larger pool of debate and think about the role in that.
Tom Streeter, author of the book The Net Effect: Romanticism, Capitalism, and the Internet. Thank you so much for joining us on Hearsay Culture. I really enjoyed the discussion. I thought the book was terrific. And I invite you back on the show to continue this discussion, because we really just touched the very tip of the iceberg today.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
This semester has been a crazy semester for me. Certainly, Tom and other guests have known this through a combination of some death in the family, my late uncle, Rabbi Alan Kay, as well as an exceptionally busy semester professionally, as well as things like my younger son, Benjamin, deciding, having been chased by his older brother, and then falling and banging his teeth, and so visits to dentists. All of that's by way of saying that I did not post the schedule this semester, and given the fact that the quarter, I should say, on KZSU's calendar is drawing to a rapid close, I don't intend to do so. The last two guests on the show will be Professor Ann Balsamo, from a professor of interactive media at USC, on her book, Designing Culture, as well as Aaron Kahana, a fellow at Codex at Stanford, discussing issues involving virtual spaces and technology. And then over the course of December, I will be putting together our schedule for the winter quarter of KZSU, beginning at the end of the year and into January and February of 2013. So you have a number of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. As always, this quarter you can listen Wednesdays at noon Pacific time. You can also get the show via podcast from iTunes, from the Center for Internet Society's webpage, as well as from hearsayculture.com. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. So I thank you for listening to the show today. I hope you've enjoyed the discussion. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.